Hi there, and welcome to the Homestead Education Podcast. Do you have a homestead, farm, or just dream of a rural life? This is a show to help you and your kids grow your own food and grow as a person. I'm your host, Cody Hanner. I'm a homesteader, homeschool mama six, and small town enthusiast. I was raised by an old school rancher and blessed by the grace of God to have been exposed to so much of what rural life has to offer. Join me every week to talk about homesteading, homeschooling, and growth with a homestead education. Hi, everybody, and welcome back. I just want to remind you that you can get all my homestead science books on my website for a new way of teaching agriculture to today's youth and aspiring homesteaders by focusing on small-scale farming and self-sufficiency. If you are a school or co-op and need invoicing, please feel free to reach out to me directly. So, hi, guys. I just felt like I needed to touch base. I haven't done one of my kind of intro videos in a few weeks because we've had some really amazing guests that we chatted for a long time, and I decided that kind of just seemed like a good length for the episode. But this week I was like, I haven't chatted with anybody. In a little while. So sorry. For those of you that watch the YouTube version of this, you're probably looking at me going like, this girl looks like she just crawled out of bed. And guess what? I did just crawl out of bed because I've been working in my garden for 2 days and the weather has been absolutely amazing. And I opened up all the doors and windows in my house and I came in from gardening to take a little break and fell asleep. And it was probably the best nap I've ever had because I had all the sunshine and fresh air and had been, you know, like working my butt off physically in the yard, which, you know, isn't something that we've been doing for a long time, you know? So yeah, that was an amazing nap and I don't even feel bad about it. So you should all be like feeling really good for me right now and super envious. So anyways, a few updates for what we've had going on around the homestead. We have sold all of our fair piglets for the year, so that's super exciting. We won't have any more piglets. We might have one litter coming up in about 6 weeks, which is really perfect for our spring litters. We kind of missed some of our breeding schedule for spring litters, which is when most people want to buy their feeder pigs. So I'm excited for that one litter, but we'll definitely have some early summer litters, which are good for people that like to overwinter pigs. And they're good for a lot of the people that like to buy pork from us, because that's when we can feed out pigs and we don't have people just really trying to buy piglets from us. So that's those are good litters for us. If you do live, you know, somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, we do offer a pay-as-you-grow program on pork. We have pigs available for that program right now that actually will be available early summer, where you can make monthly payments, or, you know, those that are going to be ready sooner, you can still make monthly payments, but they'd be slightly larger monthly payments towards your pig rather than having to pay a big lump sum all at once. And then you know, can fill your freezer. And, you know, honestly, a whole hog fills, you know, depending on your size of freezer, can either fill a whole freezer or like half a freezer. It's you get back like about 150 pounds worth of meat. So you know, average, I think it's like 129 is, you know, what I calculate out for like my official amount that you get back for a 250 pound hog. But, you know, a lot of my homestead friends, they're asking for fat back, they're asking for bones back and that type of stuff. So, I mean, they are usually getting back well over 150 pounds of product. So, I mean, it's a really good deal. And so, like I said, if you're, you know, kind of in the area and that's something that you're interested in from us, feel free and reach out. If you're a homesteader outside of the area and you just kind of want to know how we set that program up, I'm always welcome to chat with people about it. So, as for our gardens, like I said, I was out in the gardens all day today. That felt so great. I'm actually about a week behind, I'm using my air quotes, on what some of my seed packets say that I could have had, like, I think my peas and some of my greens in the ground already. But honestly, like, the weather has been horrific here. Like snow, rain mixture. I mean, there's no way I could have even been out there working my garden beds, getting them ready to plant, let alone, I mean, obviously I could have planted because I could have been underground and safe for the last week, but I don't know anybody who would have wanted to have been working in their garden in that weather. I mean, That would have been some hardcore gardening. But I got out there this week or the last couple of days. I have my two main beds that I plant my winter vegetables in. I say my winter vegetables. Those are my greens and my peas, and I put my carrots and onions in those beds. And that's where I do all my succession planting. And I have my trellises in the middle for like my peas. And I do something else in there. I don't know. Like I said, I just woke up from a nap. But I'm excited to get those going. Probably gonna be planting there maybe tomorrow. It's supposed to be almost 70 degrees tomorrow, and I have them all clean and ready to go. And then my son's been out there the rest of the day getting all of my summer beds ready to go, which is where I put my tomatoes and my squash and that type of stuff, or peppers. We have another larger garden that sometimes we'll put a lot of the squashes and pumpkins and our bean plants and corn, kind of like the Three Sisters type gar. I actually call it the Three Sisters garden. We'll put some other stuff out there too, potatoes. It has our small orchard in it. And those are all the things that like we will just till and plant right into the ground. And it just makes more sense to do that. Where then I have a garden closer to the house that I call the kitchen garden. And it's got my raised beds, and it's where I kind of can go out there and work in the evenings a little bit more. And it's where I like, oh, kids, go grab me a tomato for dinner tonight or something. So kitchen garden. So yeah, he's been working out there. I actually did a lot of videoing yesterday on Easter for a YouTube channel, or for a YouTube channel, for a YouTube video on how to prep your beds and get them ready for whether it's going to be for spring planting or for summer planting. So that'll be coming out later this week. I'm not sure which day, because they were kind of longer videos. And when I do them on my phone, it sometimes takes a couple of days for them to fully upload onto my cloud. So those will be coming out later this week. So make sure you hop over to the YouTube channel and subscribe so you can catch that. And shows one of my new toys that I got from my garden. Kind of a it's a cheaper piece of equipment that I picked up that I wasn't sure how I was going to like it, and we're actually really loving it. So you'll want to check that out. I've been telling you a little bit about the farm store we're going to open. We had hoped to do our soft opening in March, and that just didn't happen, which honestly, my soft opening was just going to be make sure the farm store was clean, and on the days we felt like being open, putting a sign out by the road. That just didn't happen because, like I said, the weather was really, really rough here, and we needed to borrow our friend's dump trailer to pull out some old furniture from there. And I wanted to get some painting done. Like, I mean, it was bad enough. I don't even know if the paint would have dried. Like, it might have. I don't know, but it was pretty bad. So I think our soft opening will definitely be happening in April because at this point, we've hauled off almost everything we need out of there, and my husband's doing all the yard work like out in front. So I think that we're definitely on the track for having that open. I have my products ready to go, and I have a couple of my friends' products that are just, I have to give them the okay, and they'll bring them up and put them on the shelf. So I'm really excited for that to happen. And then our hard opening will be late May, early June, kind of just a weekend that I'm not traveling because that is like my busy homestead, homeschool, conference, travel time, but it's also a really good time to have a plant sale here in North Idaho, which is what we're going to do is I'll do my annual plant sale, and we'll probably do like a bar, like hot dog barbecue type thing. Just give people an excuse to drive like the 40 minutes out of town to our house and then get to see all the products we have and meet our neighbors and that type of thing. Which we've been here for a while, but a lot of new people have moved in. And we have been traveling a lot, so we haven't really been cultivating relationships with some of the new people. So we're excited for that. Which on to conferences. I got home last week from a week ago today from my first homestead conference of the year, which was the Oakey Homesteading Conference in Pryor, Oklahoma. And oh my gosh, I am so excited for conference season this year. I mean, it just these conferences, they just get me going. They get me so excited. And Oki did such a wonderful job. I mean, they are just amazing there. That was a very well put together, clean, high energy conference. And I had a really, really good time. I had a wonderful booth there, lots of room to like stretch out and talk to people. I had some wonderful, wonderful conversations. My daughter Savannah, who travels with me a lot, she had an opportunity to work with people in a different way than she's been able to. We had a little bit more space. So rather than just trying to like work with people on top of each other, we were able to cultivate like better conversations and like more relationship style conversations. And I actually got some like emails and text mess or not text messages, but Instagram messages after the conference being like, I hope you and Savannah made it home safe. And I just thought it was really cool that she was kind of seen as a member of my business for the first time rather than just one of my kids. And so that was pretty cool. She's my podcast manager, so she does all of my emails and scheduling for my podcast, following up with guests. You know, she does all that. Like when I meet with people at these conferences and I get their business cards and we make plans of who's going to reach out to who and stuff, she's all the one that's doing that. And I, if somebody's asking me like if I'll come on their podcast, I immediately grab Savannah and I say like she's the one that you're going to need to contact for this, and that type of thing, so that you know faces to names, and she can get any special information and put that in her notebook and stuff. So it was really important that people are starting to see her as a part of my business, and that was really exciting for me and for her. And she'll be traveling with me to most of my conferences this year, just like she did last year. There's a few that my husband only comes with me, just because you know sometimes we need time to travel, him and I. That's really important as a married couple to be able to cultivate our relationship as well when most of our availability for travel is through my conferences. And then also Savannah has a twin brother and he likes to be able to go with me to some of these trips too. However, he doesn't work in my business the same way she does. He'll do some of my website stuff and he definitely like is the grunt. Like he'll carry, you know, he packs boxes back and forth. He runs our homestead more. And so it is really important to have him home. And also he doesn't have the customer service skills that she does. So we kind of just, we all acknowledge where everybody shines in their abilities, but he does get to travel as well. So he always gets to go, of course, when we travel as a family. And then usually one or two conferences, he gets to travel just him and I. So we get that one-on-one time, the same as Savannah and I get. So that's a lot of fun as well. I also got to meet with some wonderful gentlemen from the Farm to Table Direct show. Anything that I mention here, I'll make sure I link in the show notes, but these guys are really awesome. And what they are is they're a couple of guys that like one of them is a long haul trucker. They're brothers, and they just like they started talking while one of them was truck driving and just talking about how our system was just so messed up. And I think we all know that our system is really messed up. And they decided that they wanted to start a YouTube channel being very direct about how messed up our system is. And so now they have created this kind of talk show about how we can fix what's going on in our food system. And they were there at the Oakey Homesteading. They documented a lot of it live. They were interviewing a lot of us. It was a lot of fun. So make sure you hop over to their YouTube, their Instagram, whichever, and give them a follow. Watch some of their interviews. They're really interesting guys to talk to and to hear their points of view. So the next event I'll be going to is the Women's Homestead Society Conference in Tennessee. Angela does a beautiful job of putting together probably one of the most elegant conferences I've ever been to. I've been looking forward to this conference all year. She's gone from a one-day conference to a two-day conference. And I mean, it is such a wonderful way for women homesteaders to have an excuse to wear something other than muck boots and to network with other women, both on just having other women to talk to about their homestead, to network on businesses, and to just build these like lasting friendships. Like I have so many wonderful ladies that I talk to on a regular basis that I've met at these events. So I am looking forward to getting to Tennessee again. If you're interested in seeing my full travel schedule, it's at thehomesteadeducation.com/events, and you can see everywhere I'm going to be. If there's an event near you that you were hoping you'd be able to see my curriculum or have me speak at, feel free and reach out, and we can see if that's something that I'm available for. So, one of the things I've been speaking about a lot lately is raising self-sufficient kids. I spoke about it a lot last year. I have a couple more events this year that I'm going to be for sure speaking, that I've already been contracted to speak about it on. And it's something that I feel like I'm really uniquely qualified to talk about it on. And that's because I don't have perfect kids. And I know that it's really hard for a lot of people to get on and, kind of come out and say that. My husband and I have an eclectic group of kids. When we got married, we joke that we have yours, mine, ours, and hers. My husband was a widower when we met, and not only does he have his kids and I have my kids, and then we have kids that we've had together, we also, for a while, were raising his late wife's children from her previous marriage as well. So we kind of have this really unique group of kids that in all different age ranges. And currently, we have kids ranging from like 4 to 25. Now, I personally wasn't involved in most of the raising of the older two, or the oldest two, but I have, exclusively raised the youngest four, and almost exclusively raised my husband's oldest two. And we have faced probably darn near every challenge that there could be. I mean, we have a blended family. We have neurodivergent kids. We have kids that were raised, differently than the way we want to raise our kids. We have kids that were raised the exactly the way we want to raise our kids. And we've had kids that were exclusively homeschooled. We have kids that went to public school and then were homeschooled. We have kids that were never homeschooled. So I mean, there's like this like mix of all types of scenarios. We have kids that were raised in towns. We have kids that were raised rurally. We have kids that were only raised on the farm. And I feel like it makes it where I can talk to a lot of different scenarios. I can talk to single moms. I can talk to women who have, or I can talk to families that have, that really strong marital bonds. Just it's I have the ability to help families in all different stages and walks of life raise this concept of self-sufficient kids, which isn't just the self-sufficiency when we talk about homesteading, like baking their own bread, but that is a huge part of it, is just that desire to be able to take care of yourself. Now, whether that is just a child that you're raising to be a self-sufficient adult, rather than an adult that relies on a system or relies on someone else all the time, or if you're actually wanting to raise a child that has that bug for self-sufficiency, as in homesteading and having that kind of self-sufficient lifestyle of prepping, raising your own food and that type of thing, which really, as a society, like, I think that's a whole nother conversation, but we should be doing more of that because we are the first society to not be able to feed themselves without the reliance on someone else ever. And I think that that needs to be strongly looked at because it's a really scary concept that, like, that the majority of the world could starve to death. And that was not the case even 100 years ago. So that's really something that, as parents, we should be looking at raising self-sufficient children on that concept of being able to feed themselves. But we also need to be looking at raising self-sufficient children as in we want self-sufficient adults and not someone who's just going to be relying on someone else their whole lives. So with that, I am hosting an Instagram challenge. This is kind of the first step of a series of challenges and network and workshops and programs that I'm going to be putting together on raising self-sufficient kids, because I feel like in this realm of parenting, we have a unique set of accomplishments, a unique set of consequences, and a unique set of expectations that we have for our kids that a lot of parenting groups online don't meet, especially in the homestead world. So I can't go to most parenting groups and be like, I'm so excited my son finally decided to AI a cow. And people are like, he did what? And I'm like, he artificially inseminated a cow. Like, I got my son to stick his arm up a cow's butt, And most other homestead or most other parenting groups would be like, I don't understand why you did that. Whereas, a homestead, self-sufficient type parenting group would be like, that is wonderful. You should be so proud of him. He's going to really go places in life, Where then there's also that unique set of, how do I get my daughter to go to the barn every day and do her chores without me watching her and be able to feed five different species of animals on her own and, bring the eggs back and me not have to be there and like holding her hand. And I've actually seen in other parenting groups where they're like, you chose to homestead, you should not be making your child do this. And, as homesteaders, a lot of, we have the view of if you want to eat, you will be doing this. And so we just have these unique sets of needs as, homestead, self-sufficient parents that I would like to be able to provide that space to network, bounce ideas off each other, and, just have a safe place for that. So this Instagram challenge is going to kind of be the first place for that, where for a week I'm going to be popping in, doing lives, talking about ways that we have been raising self-sufficient kids, giving you some actionable steps to do with your family, to do with your kids, to talk to your spouse about, and then some things that you can post to encourage your friends and family and other, homesteaders in your circle to be able to do the same thing, because I guarantee you they're having some of the same struggles. And to be able to like start uplifting a group of these types of parents. So I'm really excited for it. Like I said, in the Instagram challenge is going to be the first place that I do this. But if you want to head over to the homesteadeducation.com/ homesteading kids challenge. And again, I'll link that in the show notes from April 14th through 19th. I'll be doing those lives. The ideas to post to build your homestead parent circle. And there's going to be some prizes and that types of things, like make it fun as well. And we're going to start building this community of other homestead parents. So go ahead and stay tuned for my guest today. His name is Dale Cox, and he has some super amazing ways to get kids excited about useful science. Today, I have Dale Cox from Beakers and Bricks on to talk about his background and the curriculum that he wrote from that. I have enjoyed getting to know Dale on the conference circuit, which is actually where I met him at a homeschool convention. And we're excited to get to chat again this weekend at one. So, hi, Dale.
Hey, how you doing?
Wonderful. Thank you for coming on today.
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. I fell in love with what you do, and I feel like it's so aligned with what I do as well. Just kind of teaching kids something beyond the average sciences. So, I'm really looking forward to hearing a little bit about how you wrote your books and dig into them a little bit.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So, do you want to go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and
Well, sure. It's kind of a goofy background.
love
I
it?
actually started I started out in high school. All of my friends knew me as Dr. Cox because I was going to be an orthopedic surgeon.
Oh,
I
okay.
became certified as an EMT, an emergency medical technician, and I worked doing that for a couple of years. I loved it. I loved working with the patients, and all of the terminology associated with all things medicine came fairly natural to me. Even all the
Well, it's
anatomy
better than
classes.
my high school nickname. I was the Colonel because my last name was Sanders.
There you go. But when I was working as an EMT, the doctors that I worked with in the ER, because I was on an ambulance crew, they talked me out of going to medical school, strangely enough. So yeah, this was back in the late 80s. I'm dating myself here a little. And it was right at the time when insurance changes and governmental regulation were becoming more and more onerous. And
Oh,
taking, as
yeah.
they put it, it's taking a lot of the fun out of medicine, and a lot of them are getting out, actually. So,
Similar to what's happening now.
yeah, so exactly. It's only gotten worse
Yeah.
since then. So, I still may go back and audit medical school someday, but at that point, I was looking for something else to do because that was my goal for years and years and years. And I love science, and I bounced around for a few majors. I also enjoy learning languages. I actually studied Russian for a while, and I speak Spanish.
Oh, nice.
but
Well, I might be jumping forward a little bit, but that helps in the food industry.
it does. Yeah, I actually in my professional life, I've done work in Mexico, and actually got to use Spanish in Japan, believe it or not. So.
Oh, wow.
When I was working for Kellogg's, but I had a friend who initially or eventually introduced me to what he was majoring in, which was food science, which I had never heard of before. But as a teenager, I loved to cook and, well, really to bake.
Yeah.
And I always wondered what in the world, how the ingredients interacted with one another. And of course, I'd ask my parents, and they had no idea. So he told me what it was about, and I thought, well, that sounds interesting. And I would be able to finish the degree fairly quickly because I already had most of the science behind me.
Oh, nice.
And so I jumped in, and it was just, I was
I
calling my
definitely
parents. What?
think had I known what I know now, that I probably would have at least minored in food science.
Yeah, it's very useful science. That's what I call an everyday useful science. Because even if you're not going to become a food scientist, it really helps in everything you do because it describes everything that you do in the kitchen.
Side note, there you go. There's your tagline.
Yeah, I talk about that quite a bit. So, yeah, so I got into that, and my parents, I was calling them all the time saying, "Did you know that this is why this does that?" And like, nope. And my dad, he actually said, "You need to write this stuff down because eventually this is going to become old hat to you, and you'll think everybody knows it. And then write a book someday." So I had that in the back of my mind. And but then I worked for 23 years as a professional food scientist. I graduated in 1994 with a bat with a my bachelor's and master's degree in food science. Believe it or not, you can actually get a PhD in it. And I was offered a scholarship to do that, but I was done with school. I wanted to get out and work. Had a 4-year-old at the time, and my wife and I, we have 3 kids. Our youngest was 4, or our oldest, I should say, was 4 at that point. And then for the next 23 years, I worked as a professional food scientist, mainly developing food products, but also troubleshooting production lines. And I traveled all over the world. I worked for a lot of companies that people would recognize, like Kellogg's, General Mills. I developed a Cheez-It. I worked on Honey Bunches of Oats, Gorton's Fish Sticks, Planters Nuts. And it was a great time. It's a lot of fun. And
You know, it really is. For my listeners who have been around for a while, I worked in food safety for a lot of years, which, you know, for people who just don't understand that industry, like, you know, Dale worked on worked troubleshooting the lines. I was the one who was out there and said, "You can't do it that way because it's not safe." But
you feel like, just watch me. No.
it's not safe and it's not clean. You can't do it that way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because I also did the OSHA stuff too, but
Ah.
you know, a lot of people, you tell them that you work in food safety and they imagine you the one, like, you know, sanitizing buckets in the back of the restaurant. And that was definitely, I was the boss of the people who sanitized the buckets in the back of the plant, you know. Food safety is definitely it's a very cerebral pain in the butt job.
It's necessary, though.
It is, yes. You know,
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, we were talking a little bit before the call, like in the homestead world, you know, a lot of people are kind of seeing the food industry as the enemy. And in a lot of ways, I think we both can say there's some things that probably shouldn't have happened or shouldn't still be happening. But what I definitely found in the food safety part of it is that big plants wouldn't do things the right way if they didn't have to. I mean, I'm not saying everybody's bad and stuff, but it comes down to it's about money. And a lot of the things that we had to do, I mean, I really had to push to, get ATP testers, for example, which, people who don't know is adenine triphosphate, which is the when it tells us something's alive.
Yeah,
So,
it's the basic energy molecule that we all use, even us.
yeah,
So anything that's alive.
exactly.
So, yeah.
So, $1,500 for a piece of equipment that I could go out there and after everybody clean, test the belts to see if there was anything alive on them or not. Which, even like as homesteaders, we're like, if our food is alive, that's good, but you don't want anything alive on your food that should be dead. Because then that's when you get that's when you get contamination and molding and people get sick. And people who run these lines, they go, I mean, we've never used an ATP tester. We don't need one. And then we buy one and find out that, maybe our sanitation practices weren't the best. And you learn from that type of stuff. And that was a big issue that I had on the lines. Whereas then these advancements come along and they go, oh, everybody who produces food should have an ATP tester. Well, I'm sorry if I'm selling a cottage food out of my kitchen and that's how I make my living and that's how I provide my friends and neighbors with a quality, healthy, fresh from my garden food, I can't afford an ATP tester. And that's where I have made my transition and where I help people is with those small farms and the small food producers because of that reason that they don't bridge that gap really well from what they require in big food plants to the small farmer.
Yeah. So how to help a small farmer or a producer stay keep their products safe without breaking the bank.
Safe. Yeah, exactly. And there's not a lot of white paper on that. Like, I don't know if you had to deal with a lot of, white paper law stuff, the federal regulations and those types of things, but then they create a how-to guide for businesses, but they don't do that for the small producers. And how, like, what exemptions you're allowed to do and what things you don't have to do. They don't like, they don't provide a piece of paper that says this is the law, but you don't have to do it because you're small. But that is the law. So, anyways, that was kind of a side note, but it definitely.
It's interesting because well, maybe we'll have to when I see you at the show this weekend,
Yeah.
maybe we can talk about some of the places where you worked because my experience was actually pretty good as far because I worked for some of the big guys and they were generally very careful with all of the different types. I mean, I just as an example, when I worked for Malto Mill, we were what do they call it? Commissioning a new production line for making frosted shredded wheat. And so we had a guy who was our PhD microbiologist, and he came down and we had microorganisms that mimicked the pathogenic ones like E. coli or Salmonella. So they would die and live under similar conditions. And we actually, I was helping him with this. You know, we did a huge study where we ran for days, it was just production into the garbage. Where we're actually injecting the shredded wheat biscuits with these different microorganisms, and then we would take those and he would test them and make sure you know that we had an appropriate kill step, but and then the sanitizing,
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with that one, is that was a big company who had the funds for that. It was the small companies, the emerging companies that really struggled, and but they were still required to have the same level as those big companies. So
Well,
like
and
I have
then
I worked for a bigger company that they would just, we want to sell at Costco and we want to have the best product possible. Here, take all the money, like take it all and do whatever you need to do. And those were fun to work for too.
And then on the flip side, then there's my brother. Like you say, he's down in between Austin and Dallas in Texas. And they have a little mini farm, and kind of doing the homesteading thing. They have, I don't even know how many goats. I asked him at some point, and because I went and I milked the goats when I was growing up, we had like I did like 12 a day, 12 goats twice a day by hand. I had a killer grip. But he didn't even know how many goats he had, but he had a fairly, not a large, but a following of customers that they would sell their goat milk to. And they were actually put out of business because of regulations that they were being asked to do. And like, we can't do that. We have, maybe 30 people that buy milk from us, and we can't do that. So,
And the small farmers aren't saying they don't want their food to be safe. It just they can't do it at the level that like Kellogg's could do, you know?
So my evolution has been kind of goofy, I suppose, because my fr from an outlook of developing the food products, like we were talking beforehand, I developed a Cheez-It, and I tell people that when I'm at a homeschool show, and they either think that I'm their hero or that I'm actually the devil in the flesh. So since I'm making this terrible food that we shouldn't eat,
You know
and
what, though? My perspective on it is I don't, to some extent, we didn't know. And to some extent, I will still pick up a box of Cheez-Its once in a while. So.
And that's actually the way that I look at it, because I think there's a lot of information out there that's incorrect, and my brand for my stuff is Edible Knowledge, and I really believe that knowledge gives you power, so that you're not you don't have to be beholden to whoever tells you whatever. You can find out for yourself, and I especially. I as a scientist, I don't trust anybody. I hear something, I'm like, well, that sounds good, but then I got to go figure it out for myself.
Well, and even from my perspective, I have homestead science and I tell people like I want to teach people how to homestead from a science perspective because there's so many necessary things you need to know to care for animals properly and, have your soil right. And people go, but we don't trust the science anymore. And I'm like, but I'm not that person. I'm teaching you stuff that you would find in any homestead book you buy. I'm just putting it into a science curriculum. So, yeah.
That's yeah, I'm actually a food scientist. So
Right.
from a science perspective, we have to do that. But you have to maintain the inquisitive mind and the questioning mind, as opposed to just trusting whatever's put out there. And that's where so kind of the way that I look at the whole thing is, at least from a food perspective, like packaged foods, those, I look at those, they're convenience foods. And I worked for a lot of the big companies and developed all kinds of food products across the board, and never once, was I asked to make a food that was addictive, or put in this ingredient because then people can't stop eating it. But what food companies are really good at is figuring out what a customer wants. And then with the consumer testing and everything, they dial it right in to so that it's exactly what they want. So it tastes great, and then you don't want to stop eating it. So it, but
You
it's
know
really
what?
bad business to not give customers what they want. So.
I mean, like I said, we with Cheez-Its, like my daughter will sometimes the afternoon she gets done with school and she's like, I feel like a snack. And she'll go in there and make sourdough discard Cheez-Its.
There you
You know?
Yeah.
And so I mean, she wants that flavor when we're at home. We're doing the mo probably the healthier version, healthier because it's still like a flour packed cracker,
Yep.
But yeah, we go for a drive in the we like go to town to run an errand and decide that we're gonna take like the most wooded back way home through the mountains that's gonna take us 4 hours. And we run to the grocery store and everybody grabs a Gatorade and we grab a pack of Cheez-Its. You know, I mean it's a
So
thing.
that's exactly it.
Yeah.
So the way my food philosophy, as a food scientist, and is to not, well, one, empower yourself with knowledge so that you're not afraid of whatever new thing comes out and says, hey, this ingredient's going to kill you, because most of them aren't going to. Well, none of them are going to, but some of them you should eat in
In
moderation.
moderation, yeah. Eventually, if
So
you only eat Cheez-Its,
right.
it may kill
Like
you.
the guy that did a program where he ate only McDonald's for a whole month. You know, that's just stupid. You know, he should die, you know, but the my food philosophy is we should eat as close to nature as often as we can, but when we want a treat or we need the convenience, like when we're on the road or we're traveling to homeschool shows and we shouldn't be afraid to eat, you know, a granola bar or have a snack that's in a package, from time to time. We should just try and minimize that. And actually, the way that I see it, it's not necessarily because of the ingredients that are in there, because I know what most of those are and where they come from and what they do. That's actually part of what I do. I have a whole series called Edible Knowledge for the Curious Cook, and that's my tagline for it, is it takes the mystery out of mystery ingredients and teaches you food science principles that help you become a better cook. But I demystify those ingredients. So then you know, that's where I'm giving you the power of knowledge. And most of the time you find out it's not as scary. Sometimes you find out they're a little scary. And then you can make your own decisions. So
Yeah, no, I like that. And I think that it's just as humans, we are not good at moderation.
yeah.
And I think over the last 100 years, we were sold convenience. Like, and how you talked about, like, it's not necessarily that these businesses are creating a bad or unsafe or an addictive product. It's that they are using the psychology to lock in the exact product that people will continue to buy. And again, good, bad, or indifferent, it's that people in general don't have the moderation and that they've been sold for the last 100 years that convenience is better. That you need to be busier. Here's a convenient option for you to be busier.
Yeah, it came right along. Convenience foods came right along with industrialization. And it's kind of, they kind of work together. You can't really have one without the other.
Yeah, and I mean there's even like, there's sociological stuff on, the women not working in the house anymore and working, outside of the home. I'm not saying that women shouldn't work outside of the home because I've always loved my jobs, but I also love being home with my kids, So, but it was a so, that was sociologically the role. And as that changed, that convenience was sold even more. So it just comes with a lot of the things that, like I say, like we see in the homestead movement, is that we're going, wait, hold on. I think we were sold too much of that.
And I would agree. I agree with that. I think in general, the population eats way too many convenience foods, and I believe it's responsible for an awful lot of the maladies that we see, and the illnesses that we see, the diseases. And I think that's becoming more and more clear as the years go on. But so again, the reason that I think that we should only use what I call convenience foods, pretty much anything in a package, when we need the convenience or we want a treat, isn't necessarily because of the ingredients, although there are some. It's more because it's more highly processed. And when I say that, it's like you mentioned, it's a flour packed product. You know, you normally just a straight flour packed product is like a pie crust or something, and that's a treat. That's not what we should be eating every day. We should have, you know, whole oats oatmeal or something like that. So the way I think of it, and this is kind of disgusting, But I think of it as it's as a more as a convenience foods are more are already somewhat pre-digested.
Well, and that's actually what I was from a animal science perspective. We feed like dairy cows, for example, silage, which is basically a pre-digested food, you know? I mean, it's been packed into a tube and the natural bacterias have eaten that down and made the sugars and the everything more bioavailable so that the cows can focus on milk production. So that their energy and all the extra stores they have go into the milk production. So as a human, if you're eating something that, whether we call it pre-digested or it's just broken down more from its original form, your body doesn't have to work as hard to digest that. So,
That's exactly what I tell people.
yeah, I mean, we're overweight, and I can say that myself. I'm overweight, you know, and but I say we as a society, we're sick because a lot of those, you know, when everything's pre-digested, all you're doing is taking every, like, you have access sometimes to everything that's in there, which isn't always a good thing that you should have access to.
Yeah,
And
so
then when
like a hundred gram or a 100 calorie piece of white bread versus a 100 calorie piece of homemade whole wheat bread, you know, they both technically, if you run the tests and determine how many calories they might have the same number of calories, but the whole wheat bread, you're going to get a lot less of those calories, just because it hasn't been more so highly processed. And that's so it's much more easily converted into glucose, which if you have too much of that, you get fat. So I don't
I
need any more
mean,
help with that than right.
well, and
So
you know, people, I even notice it myself. Like, if I make a s sandwich, you know, like come in the house, make myself like you know, turkey and tomato sandwich or something. Out of store-bought bread, whether it's, you know, definitely if it's white bread, but even some of the whole wheats and stuff, I can eat a whole sandwich and I'm probably still hungry.
Yeah.
Like I need, you know, fruit or chips or something else to go with it. Whereas if we make homemade bread, whether it's white bread, whole wheat bread, whatever we happen to make, you know, the kids do a lot of white bread and they're baking bread right now because honestly, we live almost an hour from town and we've been out of bread for 2 days and the kids want a sandwich for
I want a
lunch.
sandwich.
So so they're in there baking bread. But I mean, that right there, that's my self-sufficient kid speech for the
There you
day, you
go.
know?
I love
And
it.
it was actually like my twins, my son was like, "You guys never let me cook." We're like, "Because you burn everything." So my daughter this morning, she was making breakfast and he was saying he wanted sandwich bread. And she goes, "Well, then I will teach you how to make sandwich bread because you want to learn how to cook." So she is in there teaching her twin brother how to make sandwich bread. So that's kind of fun.
Hey, good
But
for
yeah.
her.
But when we make homemade bread, whether it's whole wheat, white, a blend, whatever it is, we do sourdough, I can eat a half of a sandwich with the same amount of meat and turkey
And be full.
and be full, like almost stuffed, sometimes can't finish it.
Yeah,
And I
exactly.
notice that I'm more intentional about eating it, because the flavors are so much better. Like I'm not just like mindlessly eating meat wrapped in fluff. Like I'm eating something that has a whole flavor profile.
Yeah. And you won't
So
get such a shot of glucose in your bloodstream either, because the glycemic index is lower. Is that right? Lower or higher?
I don't know.
One of those. Whichever end of the spectrum. The ability of your
You
body to
know
convert it into
what I always
glucose. So.
say as a scientist, you don't have to know everything, you just have to know where to find it. So
Exactly.
it's
I
the
love
fact that
it.
you
That's
knew that there was a glycemic index something, that's all you needed to know because you know that you can go look that up and find the answer. It's for those who
I have a whole library of books here that I use to write my courses. So.
Yeah, I definitely like I have my recliner chair in the living room and I have two bookshelves around it, just
There you
completely
go.
full of books.
So I should probably tell you how I came about with my how I started writing these things.
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
kind of alluded to it once, and that my dad was telling me, you know, way back
Yeah.
when, says you need to take notes, which I did not do. But you know what's new to you and you find fascinating. But when I was at the university, working on my graduate degree, I got a stipend from them, but part of that was I actually taught in an introductory food science course to both food scientists, budding food scientists, and budding nutritionists. So you start together in our schools, the food science and nutrition, Department of Food Science and Nutrition, and then they split at some point after that and go either nutrition or food science. So I taught the introductory course. So I was kind of reintroduced to all of these things and seeing how it was new for everybody. And eventually, I've always had kind of an entrepreneurial head. It's kind of a curse. If anybody, I mean, like you have an entrepreneurial head. It can be good, but it's I would give my left arm. I've told my wife many times if I were happy just 8 to 5. So it's an easier way to live.
I don't think I've ever, even when I had an 8 to 5 job, I'd come home and try to think of something else to be doing, a project or something to make or a side job or a consulting business on the weekends. Like it was always something more.
So we got into real estate and owned a mobile home park for like 12 years and did all kinds of apartments and stuff like that. And I'm actually a licensed general contractor in several states around here too. But anyway, I've kind of had that mindset and then always wanted to do my own thing. And was starting to feel like I wasn't doing an honest job in my day job. They were happy with what I was doing, but I was so distracted, like you say, thinking about other things I wanted to do, and then didn't feel like I was doing justice to what I needed to be doing to collect my paycheck. So I decided I'd better quit before I got into trouble there. And I wanted to write these books, but partly because I was watching what was going on in the schools. This was right when our youngest was finishing high school, and we were doing a lot of damage control, even in rural North Carolina, for stuff that he was being taught and what have you. And we thought, man, if something doesn't change, we don't have any grandkids yet, but whenever they get there, I'm going to write some books for them. So that's kind of how it started. And I wrote my the two that right now are it's a full year for junior high or high school, the introductory to food science courses.
Which I actually have here. I brought them out because now that I do this on YouTube as well, I wanted people to be able to see
Those are the guys.
what
Those
you have. And
those are the
I have this one too for kids, but I'm sure
for
you're
kids.
getting
Yep.
there.
Yep. Yeah, so those first two, that's what I started with, and those are the second editions, the ones that you just showed. And they're all
Which, like, one thing I want to show, like, real quick is like, he's going to get into it, but these are like, here's the periodic table. Like, these are sciencey books. These aren't like gimmicky, which a lot of the more hands-on sciences end up going there.
They're pretty deep. That's why they're junior high school. And then like you mentioned the kids one, they're all experiment based. The junior high school I start teaching the principles in depth. And it's all stuff that you've seen every day. I mean, it's that you see when you're making food in the kitchen, but you never knew what was going on. The one for the younger kids, the yellow book that you showed, that one is it's kind of the reverse. I have them do a simple experiment and all the experiments taste good. And then there's an explanation at the end where I describe the food science in simple terms. And I have online versions of all three of those as well now. So, but most people do them together. So that's kind of how it started. And during COVID, I had planned on getting into online at some point. During COVID, I had a homeschool group out of Virginia contact me. I was planning on going to their convention, and that got canceled. And huh?
Eve.
Yeah, HAV. Yep. Homeschool Education Association of Virginia. So they contacted me and I said, "Hey, can you do something for a week, a live course, because our parents are going nuts with their kids." Just can't do anything. So I thought up I had the idea, well, I can teach them the food science behind biscuits and caramel popcorn. So the food
Good.
science behind all the ingredients, what they are, where they come from, and what their function is in the food. And then the food science about how they go together. So, like when you're actually cooking it, what's happening to the molecules, how they're interacting. And they loved it. They had a lot of fun. They made the food at the end. And they liked it so much. I thought, I can do this all day. So that's where that Edible Knowledge for the Curious Cook series came from.
I love it.
And it's designed, as you learn those principles, it helps you become a better cook. It teaches you things like, why egg whites turn white, why beef turns gray, why you can take the same cut of beef and you can cook it, or you fry it in a pan. It's super tough, but stick it in the oven for a few hours and you have fall apart tender pot roast. All these things we know they happen, but why? And as you learn the whys, it really does help take your cooking to the next level because you can experiment with more confidence, or if something messes up, you know what to do. You might know the reason why. So I
I
have
might
now,
have
I
to pick
think.
up that program this weekend.
Yeah,
I
I've
don't have
actually
that
just.
one, and my daughter is pretty deep into her self-taught cooking right now,
There you
so.
go. Yeah, I should release popcorn today. I have two more videos to edit, and then I'm done. They're about halfway there. So either today or tomorrow. But I think it's 43 or 44 courses now out there, and
Nice.
each one's a food. They're all video. It's only online. They're all little video courses. So that one's a lot of fun. That's pretty much consumed my life now for the last 2-ish years or so. I come out with a new one every month, and it's by subscription, monthly or annual. But the books themselves, especially the junior high school ones, I've created quite a few food scientists because
Nice.
I didn't know anything about it. Like I say, when I was a kid in high school, I probably would have gone that way. I just didn't know
Well,
you could have a career doing it. So.
and I think that that's something to be said for our school systems is, they teach you like life science, biology, physics, chemistry, and then you're sent off into the world supposedly supposed to know what you want to do. I mean, you have to pick a major right out of high school or pick a job, and you're supposed to know what you want to do. And there is so much more out there. And I think that that's a beautiful thing that our homeschoolers get to learn. But I'm trying to get more of that into, I know that I'm not going to crest the public school wall, but I do have a lot of my curriculums in smaller charter and public schools because people are seeing that we need to understand that there's more out there besides just biology that like doesn't always make sense. Like I almost think we should start with something like a food science and then you take biology to understand it or something, you know?
It's again what we talked about at the beginning. It's I call it an everyday useful science, as opposed to a lot of those that you just listed that they may take and very rarely, if ever, think about again. Food science, what they learn from food science is applicable every day in the kitchen, as they're doing. It helps to keep you make you a better cook and keep you safe. So
Well, even like my son, he's always wanted to be an engineer. And more recently, he's like, I'm really more into farming than I am into engineering. And I said, he's like, but I really like the idea of still like designing things. Like, he's like, I'm having like a crisis here, you know? And I said, did you know that there's something called an agricultural engineer? And he was just like, boom, like eyes open. And I mean, he like went over to my one of my mini bookshelves and grabbed a book on the history of farm equipment and hasn't set it down since.
And there's yeah, it's amazing the stuff. So I have a section in the very first course that's intended for junior high or high school on all the different career paths that you can have as a food scientist.
Oh, wow.
And then for the ones that who are particularly interested, at the tail end of that book in an appendix, I have a sample curriculum of what they would take, and then some questions that they might ask their university of choice if they're interested.
Oh, wow.
Just to yeah. So like I said, I've created quite a few food scientists. I'm pretty excited about that.
I love that. That's
It's
amazing.
a great career path that nobody knows about. And you don't have to work and make a Cheez-It. Pretty much all of everything you see in the grocery store, even the vegetables, have food scientists behind them, and all the main restaurant chains employ them.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was watching a thing one time. Well, I'll just be honest. I was watching Grey's Anatomy. You know, it's the medical show that I've, you know, watched for years. And there was a kid that was getting a heart transplant. And he was like, I don't want the heart transplant because I don't believe that another kid should have to die so I could live. And one of the doctors said to him, why don't you live so you can become a doctor and learn how to do heart transplant, find a way to do heart transplants without somebody having to die. And I mean, I know it's like just a dumb drama show, but it like clicked for me in kind of this like conversation that we've had on this, you know, you don't have to go create a Cheez-It, but if it's something you love, why don't you become a food scientist to find a way to do it that's maybe healthier.
Oh, and there's tons of companies out there doing exactly that. So you can do that. Even within a larger company like Kellogg's, you know, they had the whole Kashi brand, and that group did things entirely different. In fact, they had even a different location, you know, that they were doing their research. So it was completely different from the mainstream food products. So, yeah. So I haven't quite figured out what I want to do yet when I grow up, I suppose. I keep finding different things that I enjoy doing. I'm also, you mentioned your son likes engineering. I started off as a chemical engineering. That's the degree I was going to get before medical school. And when I decided I didn't want to become a chemical engineer to work for my profession, although in retrospect that would have been okay. But I have a kind of that kind of a mindset. I like to create things and mechanically minded and that sort of thing. So the other course that I have, apart from food science, it's an introduction to physics and engineering, but I take it from the standpoint of simple machines, which there's a lot of stuff, but it's a deeper dive. I use Lego bricks for the experiment portion, the Technic kind, if people are familiar with that. But a lot of people see that and they think it's for the younger crowd, but it's actually for junior high school, because I go deep into the science behind how these machines work. So, because part of my whole premise that I wanted to do is whatever I put my time and effort into doing, I want it to be useful for the average person, you know, as opposed to something they'll just take and, I'm glad I'm done with that class, you know. I want it to be something that, like, for example, you guys, you know, on a farm, or me last night trying to fix my mower, you know, some of the basic principles that you learn about simple machines are applicable. And I teach them the
Absolutely.
math behind how they work and the whole bit, and then they work through the experiments and build all the machines they learn about, and then change them and actually learn, they can see and for themselves the physics and how they work. And that's actually my most popular course, which I'm not sure how to feel about that, since food science is kind of my first baby, so
Right. Well, and you know, I
but
was just
people like
thinking
it, so
while you were talking about that, my husband is an amazing mechanic, but my son is a little bit more the engineering minded, and we get him, you know, some of those kits sometimes where he can like build things and rebuild them, and they give him challenges of how to build things and stuff. And I'm like, maybe I should get your curriculum for the two of them to do together or something.
they have fun. I get a lot of great feedback from folks, and that's gratifying. I'm sure you I know we were talking, you get the same. So
I do, yeah. That's actually one. I have a mechanics course within my book, and a lot of, you know, we're at homeschool conferences. You see the dads at the homeschool conferences. They're totally checked out, standing there holding a baby in three bags, and they like that glazed blank look over their face, you know. And you know, I'm sitting there talking to the mom, and the mom's like, oh yes, we're homesteaders now because we're doing all sourdough and we're growing a garden, and he's getting more glazed over because he's just thinking of all the new projects he's going to have to do because she found my curriculum. And I open up to the page of the small engine mechanics, and immediately their eyes light up and they're like, either I don't know how to do this and this is something that I could do, or I've been wanting to figure out how to teach my son how to do this or my daughter or whatever. And I didn't know, even though I'm a good mechanic, I didn't know how to teach this. And that was the piece that has been, even like my husband, he's an amazing mechanic and he helped me write that part of the curriculum. But something that I learned in college is when I took all my food safety courses, they teach you to write work instructions, how to, and explanations at an eighth grade level, because that is the average age of food plant workers. So,
Their education level,
yeah, no, sorry, yeah, not age, education level. Thank you. We do
Wow.
not employ 14-year-olds in food plant.
Well, you never
But
know.
well, I mean, some of the farms, like, they have, if you can work at 14 in your state, like a lot of the, like I worked around a lot of pears, and the pear plants would hire the kids over the summer. But yeah, the average educational level is eighth
Level.
grade. Yeah. So when I started writing this, I was able to take all of this knowledge I had, and like the knowledge my husband gave me, and put it into something that meets that about eighth grade level, which was perfect for, like, junior high, high school level curriculums. And I think that's been the real kicker with families being excited about it, is it can meet everybody at that level. So, like, even a parent who's like, I've had, parents that were ag majors, were farmers, but I wasn't sure how to teach this. And that's, I think, something that you definitely have as well. Like the cooking, like, the kids ask why. They ask why for a long time, and they'll continue to ask why if you don't squelch that.
And it's interesting you mentioned the eighth grade level, because as a professional food scientist, writing the things that my first edition I had, I hired an editor. But pretty much it was just grammar. And after it was kind of a trial, I had no idea what I'm doing. This is, I've never written a book before.
Well, my first edition, the content was great and the grammar sucked. So,
But the content was a little nebulous, I guess. People didn't quite understand what I was trying to say, because I talk like a scientist a lot of the time. I hired an editor. She was really good. I don't know if you've got a good one or not at this point, but
I'll have to hit you up on that one.
and she's actually in, I think she's in Washington,
Oh,
actually.
wow.
And she and I, we worked, we actually spent, I think it was 6 months just on one book, back and
Wow.
forth and back and forth and back and forth. And that's specifically part, one of the things we tried to work on was to make them as clear as possible. And we did that for all of the books, all four of them. The hardest one was the one for kids,
Oh, I
for the
bet.
little kids, because I had no idea how to do that. So,
I actually struggled with that one too, because what is too much information and what is too little?
So, because my whole thing was make it useful. I'm like, well, how do I make it useful? And
Where then,
yet,
like the junior high,
not.
high
So,
school one, I'd ask if it's too much, I'm adding it. But sometimes a lot of my too much was breeding, butcher, those types of things that. Is it too much to add that information? Is it too much to add a link to that? And I decided that if you really want to be a homesteader, you need to learn those things. It's part of life. And so if I questioned it, I added it.
Like the popcorn course I mentioned for the Curious Cook one, I keep tending to get longer. My lessons are getting, they're, most of them are like 3 to 5 minutes, and they're trending upwards, so I've got to try and trim them a little more. But like, I did a whole microwave technology and susceptor boards, if you know what susceptor boards are. I have a whole lesson on susceptor boards. They're the little, if you've ever made microwave popcorn in a bag, there's again something you should only do if you need the convenience, like in a hotel room or something. But this side up, you put it this side up. That's because on the bottom side, there's a very thin piece of metal actually in there. It's actually almost a metal fabric that interacts with microwave energy and gets really hot. It gets it up to like frying temperatures, really. And so it heats up the oil, and the oil is only in there to facilitate transfer of heat to the popcorn kernels, and then pop it. So I get into those. I have a susceptor board lesson in there, and I give them several examples. But trying to stay out of the weeds on the science is really hard for me because I love
Yeah, I'm bad at the rabbit trails. I'm like,
Yeah, so it's
even
a
in
constant
conversation,
battle.
I go off on the tangents because I'm like, oh, speaking of that.
Right. Yeah, I tried to do those when I first started to make those lessons. I tried to do it ad-libbing, like okay, I'd just turn on the camera and I'd start talking to it, and like it was evident within like 3 minutes that this was not going to work. So
Right, I
now I write a script
yeah.
and I edit it down and I edit it down and then I read the script. And the fun thing is that's actually become the favorite part of those courses for people, is I'm always screwing up when I read the script. So I used to just delete it, but now I have a blooper reel. So
You know what? I like with this podcast, I used to just edit the, crud out of it because I was like, oh, I said or I misspoke or I made a weird joke or my guest had a dog throw up in the background or something. And now I'm just like, part of it is that, in the homestead world, it's just about life. And so I leave it all in there
Oh
and
yeah, that's fun
it's
stuff.
great. So,
Yeah, I do edit out because it'll take me several tries sometimes to get through a tongue twister sentence or something, and I'll edit that out, but then I keep it for the
For
blooper
the
reel.
YouTube, my kids do want me to do a blooper reel because,
Oh yeah.
we always have the 4-year-old getting in the middle of it, or my daughter and I were nervous before we start every time. And so we'll turn on the camera and record it, but do like a get your wiggles out, and like do all these funny faces and stuff. And I was like, that would be fun to like just a whole like reel of our getting the wiggles out.
That's fun. We learn as we go along, right? As
We
course
do,
creators. So.
absolutely. So we're kind of getting close to the end of our time.
Oh, yep.
So, my favorite question to ask everyone is, what does keep growing mean to you?
Keep growing. Ah, well, a lot of things come to mind.
Right?
But primarily knowledge, I guess. The never stop. I love it. I think my oldest son is very, very mildly autistic, what they used to call Asperger's. And whatever he got interested in, he within a fairly short period of time, he would get like a master's degree level of education in it. Even though he never got along with public schooling, organized schooling, couldn't he would ace the tests but never turn an assignment in to save his life because he's way smarter than me. But
That's my
that
son
just
out there with his
really
Oh, history of farm mechanics books.
so that would be my first, that would be the primary thing that comes to mind, is to never stop learning. I mean, whenever we stop, I feel like that's it. So
I
then we might
agree.
as well be done. So
So, do you want to tell everyone where they can find you?
oh yeah. Well, if you're looking on the screen, I have a QR code that takes me to our website. That's edible-knowledge.com. Just still trying to buy the quote the straight edible-knowledge.com from somebody else.
Yeah,
or
that's why I
Beakers.
have the homestead education.
Yep.
So,
BeakersandBricks.com gets there too. And there's links on there where you can go. The Edible Knowledge for the Curious Cook series. Right on that main page, there's a link that will take you to that and give you a lot more information about it. So right there, you can get everything.
that's awesome. And I'll link all that in the show notes.
Sounds great.
All right. Well, looking forward to chatting again soon.
All right. Thanks, Cody.
Thank you. Did you enjoy today's episode? If so, please head over to your favorite podcast player and leave a comment and review. This helps me to know what you're enjoying and helps others find an episode that can help them. Thank you for joining me today at the Homestead Education, and I hope that I have given you something to think about this week. To help others find me, please comment and leave a review on your favorite podcast player. You can also follow me on Facebook at the Homestead Education and Instagram at homestead_education. Do you have questions that you would like answered or just want to say hi? Please email me at hello@thehomesteadeducation.com. Until next time, keep growing!